to the premature conquest of power is at the bottom nothing more than a general opposition to the aspiration of the proletariat to possess itself of state power. Just as all roads lead to Rome, so too do we logically arrive at the conclusion that the revisionist proposal to slight the final aim of the socialist movement is really a recommendation to renounce the socialist movement itself.
Chapter 9. Collapse.
Bernstein began his revision of the social democracy by abandoning the theory of capitalist collapse. The latter, however, is the cornerstone of scientific socialism. By rejecting it, Bernstein also rejects the whole doctrine of socialism. In the course of his discussion, he abandons one after another of the positions of socialism in order to be able to maintain his first affirmation. Without the collapse of capitalism, the expropriation of the capitalist class is impossible. Bernstein therefore renounces expropriation and chooses a progressive realization of the cooperative principle as the aim of the labour movement. But cooperation cannot be realized without capitalist production. Bernstein therefore renounces the socialization of production and merely proposes to reform commerce and to develop consumers' cooperatives. But the transformation of society through consumers' cooperatives, even by means of trade unions, is incompatible with the real material development of capitalist society. Therefore, Bernstein abandons the materialist conception of history. But his conception of the march of economic development is incompatible with the Marxist theory of surplus value. Therefore, Bernstein abandons the theory of value and surplus value, and in this way the whole economic system of Karl Marx. But the struggle of the proletariat cannot be carried on without a given final aim and without an economic base found in the existing society. Bernstein therefore abandons the class struggle and speaks of reconciliation with bourgeois liberalism. But in a class society, the class struggle is a natural and unavoidable phenomenon. Bernstein therefore contests even the existence of classes in society. The working class is for him a mass of individuals, divided politically and intellectually, but also economically. And the bourgeoisie, according to him, does not group itself politically in accordance with its inner economic interest, but only because of exterior pressure from above and below. But if there is no economic base for the class struggle, and consequently there are no classes in our society, not only the future, but even the past struggles of the proletariat against the bourgeoisie appear to be impossible, and the social democracy and its successes seem absolutely incomprehensible, or they can be understood only as the results of political pressure by the government, that is, not as the natural consequence of historic development, but as the fortuitous consequences of the policy of the Hohenzollern, not as the legitimate offspring of capitalist society, but as the bastard children of reaction. Rigorously logical in this respect, Bernstein passes from the materialist conception of history to the outlook of the Frankfurter Zeitung and the Vossische Zeitung. After rejecting the socialist criticism of capitalist society, it is easy for Bernstein to find the present state of affairs satisfactory, at least in a general way. Bernstein does not hesitate. He discovers that at the present time reaction is not very strong in Germany and that we cannot speak of political reaction in the countries of Western Europe, and that in all the countries of the West the attitude of the bourgeois classes toward the socialist movement is at most an attitude of defence and not one of oppression. Vorwärts, March 26, 1899. Far from becoming worse, the situation of the workers is getting better. Indeed, the bourgeoisie is politically progressive and morally sane. We cannot speak either of reaction or oppression. It is all for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Bernstein thus travels in logical sequence from A to Z. He began by abandoning the final aim and supposedly keeping the movement. But as there can be no socialist movement without a socialist aim, he ends by renouncing the movement. And thus Bernstein's conception of socialism collapses entirely. The proud and admirable symmetric construction of socialist thought becomes for him a pile of rubbish in which the debris of all systems, the pieces of thought of various great and small minds find a common resting place. Marx and Proudhon, Leon von Buch and Franz Oppenheimer, Friedrich Albert Lang and Kant, Herr Prokopovich and R. Ritter von Neupauer, Herkner and Schulze Gevernitz, LaSalle and Professor Julius Wolff, all contribute something to Bernstein's system. From each he takes a little. There is nothing astonishing about that. For when he abandoned scientific socialism, he lost the axis of intellectual crystallization, around which isolated facts grouped themselves in the organic whole of a coherent conception of the world. His doctrine, composed of bits of all possible systems, seems upon first consideration to be completely free from prejudices. For Bernstein does not talk of party science, or to be more exact, of class science, any more than he likes to talk of class liberalism or class morality. He thinks he succeeds in expressing human, general, abstract science, abstract liberalism, and abstract morality. But since the society of reality is made up of classes, which have diametrically opposed interests, aspirations, and conceptions, a general human science in social questions, an abstract liberalism, an abstract morality, are at present illusions, pure utopia. The science, the democracy, the morality considered by Bernstein as general, human, are merely the dominant democracy and dominant morality, that is, bourgeois science, bourgeois democracy, bourgeois morality. When Bernstein rejects the economic doctrine of Marx in order to swear by the teachings of Brentano, Böhm, Bawerk, Jevons, Say, and Julius Wolff, he exchanges the scientific base of the emancipation of the working class for the apologetics of the bourgeoisie. When he speaks of the generally human character of liberalism and transforms socialism into a variety of liberalism, he deprives the socialist movement generally of its class character and consequently of its historic content, consequently of all content, and conversely, recognises the class representing liberalism in history, the bourgeoisie, as the champion of the general interests of humanity. And when he wars against raising of the material factors to the rank of an all-powerful force of development, when he protests against the so-called contempt for the ideal that is supposed to rule the social democracy, when he presumes to talk for idealism, for morals, pronouncing himself at the same time against the only source of the moral rebirth of the proletariat, a revolutionary class struggle, he does no more than the following: preach to the working class the quintessence of the morality of the bourgeoisie, that is, reconciliation with the existing social order and the transfer of the hopes of the proletariat to the limbo of ethical simulacra. When he directs his keenest arrows against our dialectic system, he is really attacking the specific mode of thought employed by the conscious proletariat in its struggle for liberation. It is an attempt to break the sword that has helped the proletariat to pierce the darkness of its future. It is an attempt to shatter the intellectual arm with the aid of which the proletariat, though materially under the yoke of the bourgeoisie, is yet enabled to triumph over the bourgeoisie. For it is our dialectical system that shows to the working class the transitory nature of this yoke, proving to workers the inevitability of their victory, and is already realizing a revolution in the domain of thought. Saying goodbye to our system of dialectics and resorting instead to the intellectual seesaw of the well-known on the one hand, on the other hand, yes, but, although, however, more, less, etc., he quite logically lapses into a mode of thought that belongs historically to the bourgeoisie in decline, being the faithful intellectual reflection of the social existence and political activity of the bourgeoisie at that stage. The political, on the one hand, on the other hand, yes, but of the bourgeoisie today, resembles in a marked degree Bernstein's manner of thinking, which is the sharpest and surest proof of the bourgeois nature of his conception of the world. But as it is used by Bernstein, the word bourgeois itself is not a class expression, but a general social notion. Logical to the end, he has exchanged, together with his science, politics, morals, and mode of thinking, the historic language of the proletariat for that of the bourgeoisie. When he uses without distinction the term citizen in reference to the bourgeois as well as to the proletarian, intending thereby to refer to man in general, he identifies man in general with the bourgeois, and human society with bourgeois society. Chapter 10. Opportunism in Theory and Practice. Bernstein's book is of great importance to the German and the international labour movement. It is the first attempt to give a theoretic base to the opportunist currents common in the social democracy. These currents may be said to have existed for a long time in our movement, if we take into consideration such sporadic manifestations of opportunism as the question of subsidisation of steamers. But it is only since about 1890, with the suppression of the anti-socialist laws, that we have had a trend of opportunism of a clearly defined character. Vollmar's State Socialism, the vote on the Bavarian budget, the agrarian socialism of South Germany, Heine's policy of compensation, Schippel's stand on tariffs and militarism, are the high points in the development of our opportunist practice. What appears to characterise this practice above all? A certain hostility to theory. This is quite natural, for our theory, that is, the principles of scientific socialism, impose clearly marked limitations to practical activity, insofar as it concerns the aim of this activity, the means used in attaining those aims, and the method employed in this activity. It is quite natural for people who run after immediate practical results to want to free themselves from such limitations and to render their practice independent of our theory. However, this outlook is refuted by every attempt to apply it in reality. State socialism, agrarian socialism, the policy of compensation, the question of the army, all constituted defeats to our opportunism. It is clear that if this current is to maintain itself, it must try to destroy the principles of our theory and elaborate a theory of its own. Bernstein's book is precisely an effort in that direction. That is why at Stuttgart, all the opportunist elements in our party immediately grouped themselves around Bernstein's banner. If the opportunist currents in the practical activity of our party are an entirely natural phenomenon which can be explained in the light of the special conditions of our activity and its development, Bernstein's theory is no less natural an attempt to group these currents into a general theoretic expression, an attempt to elaborate its own theoretic conditions, and the break with scientific socialism. That is why the published expression of Bernstein's ideas should be recognised as a theoretic test for opportunism and as its first scientific legitimisation. What was the result of this test? We have seen the result. Opportunism is not a position to elaborate a positive theory capable of withstanding criticism. All it can do is to attack various isolated theses of Marxist theory, and just because Marxist doctrine constitutes one solidly constructed edifice, hope by this means to shake the entire system from the top to its foundation. This shows that opportunist practice is essentially irreconcilable with Marxism, but it also proves that opportunism is incompatible with socialism, the socialist movement, in general. That its internal tendency is to push the labour movement into bourgeois paths, that opportunism tends to paralyse completely the proletarian class struggle. The latter, considered historically, has evidently nothing to do with Marxist doctrine, for before Marx and independently from him, there have been labour movements and various socialist doctrines, each of which, in its way, was the theoretic expression corresponding to the conditions of the time, of the struggle of the working class for emancipation. The theory that consists in basing socialism on the moral notion of justice, on a struggle against the mode of distribution, instead of basing it on a struggle against the mode of production, the conception of class antagonism as an antagonism between the poor and the rich, the effort to graft the cooperative principle on capitalist economy, all the nice notions found in Bernstein's doctrine already existed before him, And these theories were, in their time, in spite of their insufficiency, effective theories of the proletarian class struggle. They were the children's seven-league boots, thanks to which the proletariat learned to walk upon the scene of history. But after the development of the class struggle and its reflex in its social conditions had led to the abandonment of these theories, and to the elaboration of the principles of scientific socialism, there could be no socialism, at least in Germany, outside of Marxist socialism, and there could be no socialist class struggle outside of the social democracy. From then on, socialism and Marxism, the proletarian struggle for emancipation and the social democracy, were identical. That is why the return to pre-Marxist socialist theories no longer signifies today a return to the seven-league boots of the childhood of the proletariat, but a return to the puny, worn-out slippers of the bourgeoisie. Bernstein's theory was the first and at the same time the last attempt to give a theoretic base to opportunism. It is the last because in Bernstein's system opportunism has gone, negatively through its renunciation of scientific socialism, positively through its marshalling of every bit of theoretic confusion possible, as far as it can. In Bernstein's book, opportunism has crowned its theoretic development. Just as it completed its practical development on the position taken by Schippel on the question of militarism, and has reached its ultimate conclusion. Marxist doctrine can not only refute opportunism theoretically, it alone can explain opportunism as a historic phenomenon in the development of the party. The forward march of the proletariat on a world historic scale to its final victory is not, indeed, so simple a thing. The peculiar character of this movement resides precisely in the fact that here, for the first time in history, the popular masses themselves, in opposition to the ruling classes, are to impose their will, but they must effect this outside of the present society, beyond the existing society. This will the masses can only form in a constant struggle against the existing order. The union of the broad popular masses with an aim, reaching beyond the existing social order, the union of the daily struggle with the great world transformation, that is the task of the social democratic movement, which must logically grope on its road of development between the following two rocks, abandoning the mass character of the party, or abandoning its final aim, falling into bourgeois reformism or into sectarianism, anarchism or opportunism. In its theoretic arsenal, Marxist doctrine furnished, more than half a century ago, arms that are effective against both of these two extremes. But because our movement is a mass movement, and because the dangers menacing it are not derived from the human brain, but from social conditions, Marxist doctrine could not assure us in advance and once for always against the anarchist and opportunist tendencies. The latter can be overcome only as we pass from the domain of theory to the domain of practice, but only with the help of the arms furnished us by Marx. Bourgeois revolutions, wrote Marx half a century ago, like those of the 18th century, rush onward rapidly from success to success. Their stage effects outbid one another. Men and things seem to be set in flaming brilliance. Ecstasy is the prevailing spirit. But they are short-lived, they reach their climax speedily and then society relapses into a long fit of nervous reaction before it learns how to appropriate the fruits of its period of feverish excitement. Proletarian revolutions, on the contrary, such as those of the 19th century, criticise themselves constantly interrupt themselves in their own course, come back to what seems to have been accomplished in order to start anew, scorn with cruel thoroughness the half-measures, weakness and meanness of their first attempts, seem to throw down their adversary only to enable him to draw fresh strength from the earth and again to rise up against them in more gigantic stature, constantly recoil in fear before the undefined monster magnitude of their own objects, until finally that situation is created which renders all retreats impossible and conditions themselves cry out, "Hic Rhodus, hic Salta, here is the rose, and here we must dance."